The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Land Rover. With a new Land Rover as your companion, you'll see adventure wherever you go. Visit your local Land Rover retailer for special offers on the 2019 Range Rover. Adventure, it's yours for the taking. Land Rover, above and beyond.
Floor 38.
I'm so excited to be having a conversation with someone when they have that revelation.
It's making sure
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The big story going into the midterm elections has been the possibility of a blue wave, a Democratic upsurge that's notable for the number of women running and for progressive candidates like Beto O'Rourke in Texas and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. But another story in this election is the very opposite. The candidates who are running as extremists on the right, openly white supremacist candidates, even neo-Nazis. Andrew Marantz has been covering the movement known as the alt-right, and he's watching how it influences mainstream politics. Andrew, you've been reporting on the fringes of right-wing nationalism and all the associated movements, people like Mike Cernovich, for example, who was involved in Pizzagate. And you've also written about the Nazi website Daily Stürmer, which is built on Der Stürmer of Nazi lore. We've seen a lot of this on the internet, but it's been many years since really far-right white supremacists have been running for office in the United States of America. When did this all start? What are the origins of it?
It's never really not existed, but in terms of the most recent resurgence of it, you know, Trump has a lot to do with it. I mean, there's always been dog whistle politics, right? And we should definitely note that Democrats have engaged in it, Republicans have engaged in it. But it's not even really a dog whistle anymore. It's kind of just a whistle. You know, there's more and more openness with people just espousing white nationalist views, and that has a lot to do with Trump.
Well, people would point out that when Ronald Reagan was first campaigning for president, he campaigned and gave a big speech in Neshoba County, Mississippi, and he talked there about nothing less than states' rights. And this was at the very least a dog whistle to the far right. Is that something different and why?
Because he vociferously denied it. When people asked him, he said, states' rights doesn't mean that. When people asked Nixon, what do you mean by silent majority? What do you mean by law and order? He vociferously denied it. They're not really denying it anymore. So people like, you know, Steve King, who is a congressman in Iowa, he's not flirting with the line. He doesn't believe that these lines should exist.
So what is Steve King's history? What has he said and done?
So Steve King is a congressman from Iowa. He's represented the western part of Iowa for 15 years at this point. He's running for re-election in November. And he's very clearly into, you know, dog whistle racism. He talks a lot about Western civilization and European heritage and that kind of stuff. But he always, in the past, would leave some plausible deniability. And then just in the last couple of years, partly because of Trump and partly because he has a Twitter account, he has been saying things like, demographics are our destiny. And then he says, we can't restore our civilization with someone else's babies. There's no way to read that that doesn't take our civilization to mean white people. There's no plausible reading of it other than a white nationalist reading.
Does he deny it?
Well, not really. I mean, he kind of gets called to the mat and says, no, I don't regret saying that. He doesn't take down tweets. He doesn't delete them. He kind of says, oh, this, you know, PC culture, everybody gets called racist all the time. You know, you guys are always pearl clutching and stuff. But he never walks back the actual substance, nor does he ever, like, explain how that could mean anything other than white nationalism.
Well, let's talk about what we're talking about. Let's listen to one of Steve King's statements about diversity. This is from an interview that he gave to an Iowa radio program.
And when you start accentuating the differences, then you end up with people that are at each other's throats. And he's adding up Hispanics and blacks, and he predicts will be in greater number than whites in America. I will predict the Hispanics and the blacks will be fighting each other before that happens.
What do you make of that?
I mean, there are much more extreme examples of his rhetoric than that. But basically, that's kind of a turning the tables of saying, by talking about the black voting bloc or the Hispanic voting bloc, anyone doing that is therefore the racist. Paul Ryan, you know, the Speaker of the House, was asked where do you stand on this? And he waits 3 days or something, and then I forget how long he waited. But Paul Ryan puts out this very carefully worded statement that doesn't mention Steve King's name at all, that just says, we abhor racism. So in other words, it's not like he's such an outlier that the rest of the GOP can very comfortably wash their hands of him and say he's not our guy. He is their guy. They're not pulling funding from him, at least not in a way that they're making public.
So what does it suggest about American politics that the most powerful leader in one of the houses of Congress, Paul Ryan, feel they cannot afford to reject somebody like King?
Yeah, it's terrifying. It means that they've read the tea leaves and they know that this is too big a part of their support base to give up on.
You've spent the last year marinating in the juices of what one could call cyber proto-fascism.
Unfortunately.
You're talking to a lot of people who are the very most active players and voices in what you're calling proto-fascism. And what does it tell you about American political life?
Look, I think it's not that everything has utterly transformed and, you know, we weren't close to the brink and now we are. I mean, we're closer now for sure. But
what is the brink?
Well, it can't happen here. You know, that notion that, you know, yeah, fascism could have happened in Europe, but it can't happen here. I think we're now all starting to see that there's no law of nature that says that.
That walls off the United States.
Yeah, that we are an extremely flawed society with an extremely dicey racial history that perhaps uniquely so among the countries we're talking about. Democracy is a very delicate, tricky thing, right? If Steve King is now going out there and is essentially saying to the people of Iowa, hello, I'm a white nationalist. Do you want to vote for me or do you want to vote for the other guy? There's no guarantee that they want to vote for the other guy.
Well, let's talk about the other guy. His opponent, King's opponent, is a Democrat, a former baseball player named J.D. Scholten. Does Scholten have a chance? And what are the dynamics of that race look like?
He's much taller, so that's generally a good thing in politics. He's 6'6". And he's driving around the district in a Winnebago and, you know, shaking everyone's hand and being very folksy. He's out fundraising King. He's still down in the polls. I mean, incumbency is a very powerful thing in House elections, and King has been there for 6 terms.
What's the district like?
It's deep, deep red, as they say. And King, you know, you might not know this from looking at his Twitter feed, but racism is not his only thing. You know, he also, you know, wants ethanol subsidies, and he also, you know, says he wants to support farmers. Now, he's been in Congress for 15 years. He has sponsored exactly one bill that passed, which was to rename a post office in Iowa. So he's not the most effective legislator.
Now that we live in the age of Trump, are there new politicians on the scene who seem to be entering the stage or coming onto the stage in a way they might not have before?
Yeah, I think someone like Corey Stewart, he was someone who the Virginia GOP just thought would fizzle out.
And he's running for Senate.
He's running for Senate against Tim Kaine, who will probably win, but, you know.
What's his level of support?
He's doing better than one would expect. I mean, he won the primary, and his whole national image is based on being standing up for these Confederate monuments. We can't tear them down. They're our heritage. He was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota. So,
not the heart of the Confederacy.
Not the heart of the Confederacy. And Steve King, by the way, used to have a Confederate flag on his desk in the Capitol building, which, by the way, Iowa sent a lot of soldiers to die to fight against the Confederacy. So it's like, gee, I wonder what that flag means to you.
In New Jersey, in the state of New Jersey, a New Jersey congressman, Seth Grossman, was dropped by the Republican Party after saying that diversity is crap. Is that an outlier incident? Is that a very rare instance of the party standing up to some of its extremist voices?
Yeah, I think the Seth Grossman thing was a bit of an anomaly. I mean, you have even more anomalous cases than that. You have a guy named Arthur Jones in Illinois who is literally a Nazi who stands in front of Nazi flags and gives speeches. And he won a GOP primary in a district where it's heavily Democratic, and so they don't bother to run a lot of Republicans in these races. So he's not going to win the general election. It's very scary that a literal Nazi is running for office in Illinois, and that this guy Seth Grossman is running for office in New Jersey. But those are outliers. I mean, so I don't want to paint the picture that, you know, this is happening everywhere all the time. But again, the fact that someone like Seth Grossman in New Jersey. Would have, you know, concealed his feelings a little bit more just a couple of years ago. But now
he's unleashed.
He's unleashed. He's linking to this blog post, you know, calling black people inherently dangerous. And, you know, he's just posting this on his website. And then he says, oh, well, I'm Jewish, so I can't be racist. So...
False.
Yeah, I can falsify that one with personal...
Andrew, a century ago, there was a second flowering of the Ku Klux Klan. And there were Ku Klux Klan members in Congress, Ku Klux Klan members in every business organization and chamber of commerce in the country. It was like a social movement in some ways. Ku Klux Klan barbecues and block parties and all the rest. It was somewhat different from the first flowering of the Ku Klux Klan, but it was the Klan nevertheless. Is that kind of mass acceptance of white supremacy, organized white supremacy, a possibility?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, this is... I do think it ebbs and flows, and I think it's important to note that when the year anniversary march happened, there was no one there. I mean, literally like 15 people there.
The year anniversary march of Charlottesville.
Of Charlottesville, right. So that Jason Kessler tried to go to D.C. and do it again, and no one went with him. Things do change, but I do think it is possible for this kind of broad-based, you know, racism as a fun social club thing to take off again. You know, the Proud Boys are a social club. The Proud Boys are this group of, you know, they call themselves Western chauvinists. They deny being a white pride organization, but they're a quote-unquote Western pride organization. And the Proud Boys, just this past weekend, were in the streets of Manhattan beating people up. And they brand themselves as a social club, but they're also a violent street gang. So that is happening.
What's the importance of the midterm elections in this story, in this ongoing, very perilous story about American political feeling, but also the fragility of American political institutions?
I think it'll be a test of a lot of things. In this conversation, we often want to say Donald Trump is a black swan. He's a once-in-a-lifetime candidate. He can say things that no one else can say, all of which may, in a sense, be true. But there's another sense in which he blows the door off the hinges and allows other things to creep in. But also, on the larger, you know, sort of 30,000-foot view, these deep strains of playing to xenophobia, playing to fears, that stuff doesn't go away. So, you know, I think we are at a high ebb of how open it is right now, because it's not that hard to hide this stuff. The dog whistle is not that hard to get across. The fact that they don't even feel the need to conceal it even that vaguely.
What do you fear most?
Well, I fear that, you know, there will be one or two people in every state who start winning congressional races who say, yeah, why can't we just go back to being a white country? You know, why is that so wrong?
And to fight that is to be PC.
Right. You know, part of what Trump is able to do is just by lying so aggressively and so full-throatedly and so shamelessly about stupid things, he's able to put people in this mindset where, oh, racism is a meaningless word. You know, I'm seeing the racism right in front of me, and yet I'm not registering it because it's my team, right? Because I have an R next to my name and they have an R next to their name. I mean, I strongly believe that there are a lot of people in Iowa who, if you asked them to think clearly about this, they would not stand for it. But because politics has turned into a team sport, they don't want to think, oh, can I really belong to this coalition that includes this guy that I actually find odious? They don't want to go there.
Andrew Morantz writes about many things for The New Yorker, including the far right and white supremacist movement. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Ahead this hour, Jeffrey Toobin sits down to talk with Sally Yates, a 27-year veteran of the Justice Department and a 10-day veteran of the Trump administration.
And then what happened?
I was fired.
You were fired by Donald Trump before it was fashionable to be fired by Donald Trump.
It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Land Rover. Invest in Rocky Mountain Passes. Trade in hedge funds for tropical rainforest funds. Put your money into wondrous real estate you won't find on any broker's website. Adventure, it's yours for the taking. With a new Land Rover as your companion, you'll see adventure wherever you go. Visit your local Land Rover retailer for special offers on the 2019 Range Rover. Adventure, it's yours for the taking. Land Rover, above and beyond.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this month at the New Yorker Festival, our weekend-long bonanza of interviews and live events of all kinds, Sally Yates sat down with the legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin. Yates is a former deputy attorney general, and she served under Republican and Democratic presidents. But now she's emerged as a prominent critic of the Trump administration. And her name is being whispered as a possible candidate for high office. Now, that's a possibility she usually downplays, but she hasn't shut it down entirely. Here's Jeffrey Toobin, a staff writer at The New Yorker, with Sally Yates.
Sally was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. She went to the University of Georgia. She went to the University of Georgia Law School. And in 1989, she became an assistant U.S. attorney in the city of Atlanta. She prosecuted a lot of big cases, including Eric Rudolph, who was the white supremacist who bombed the 1986 Olympics. And in 2010, President Obama appointed Sally the U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Georgia, which is Atlanta. And in 2015, she was confirmed as Deputy Attorney General of the United States. On January 20th, 2017, briefly but eventfully, she became the Attorney General of the United States, and that's where our story is going to start. January 20th, 2017, where were you? What happened?
Well, you're right, I was serving as Deputy Attorney General, and there is a tradition at the Department of Justice that in the transition time in administrations, the Deputy Attorney General of the prior administration serves as the acting AG for the incoming administration. To maintain continuity, you know, it's important in any agency, particularly DOJ, but there's another tradition as well.
Which is?
Nothing happens during that time. My chief of staff told me I would have nothing to do, so there would be plenty of time for, in her words, long boozy lunches.
On January 24th, 4 days later, Michael Flynn, the incoming national security advisor, was interviewed by the FBI. The next day, the 25th, the FBI came to you.
God, this seems like a lifetime ago.
I know. It's ancient history, but trust me, it's interesting.
Okay. Well, an issue had arisen with respect to sanctions that President Obama had imposed and that actually had strong bipartisan support, sanctions against the Russians based on their interference in our election. And it was very strange that despite the imposition of these sanctions, the Russians didn't do anything in response. And so the intel community was trying to figure that out. And in the course of that, discovered that Mike Flynn, who was going to be the incoming National Security Advisor, had been having discussions with Mr. Kislyak, who was the Russian ambassador, essentially imploring him not to do anything in response to those sanctions. But then the situation got a lot worse because people in the administration, starting with Sean Spicer and others, and ultimately culminating in Vice President Pence, went out and were telling the American people that there had been no such discussions. We knew, because we had recordings of these conversations, that we weren't the only ones who knew that General Flynn was providing false information ostensibly to people in the administration who were then providing false information to the American people. We weren't the only ones who knew that. The Russians knew that too. And because this had become such a big public thing, this is precisely the kind of information they would love to be able to hold over the head of the National Security Advisor, which made him potentially compromised.
Compromised. It's a blackmail. So what did you do? What happened next?
So I contacted Don McGahn, who
the White House counsel,
and told him that I needed to come see him right away, told him what we had learned, that, you know, the vice president had been on Face the Nation and is saying, you know, I've talked to General Flynn personally, and he has assured me that there were no conversations about sanctions. So you got the VP out there saying this stuff. So we told Mr. McGahn, how we knew that it wasn't true, how we happened to have recordings of these conversations, and why we thought it was a problem.
And you go see him a second time on January 27th?
Yeah, he asked me to come back.
Was that different or the same, or what was?
It was a little different in the sense that he was a bit more combative, I guess I would say, in this discussion. And I've testified before that sort of one of his first questions was, what's it to the Department of Justice if one White House official lies to another?
And what did you make of that?
Well, I tried to explain to him that it was a whole lot more than just one White House official lying to another, which, God, I would hope he would be concerned about anyway, but that it was more than that, that the underlying conduct here, that General Flynn having these discussions to begin with is problematic. But beyond that, again, it's the issue of compromise, that the Russians know this, it provides potential leverage, and this is a problem. And we also thought, that Vice President Pence was entitled to know that the stuff that he was saying when he stood, in front of the public, that wasn't true. So we were trying to help them.
So your second meeting with Don McGahn is January 27th. Yeah. Also on January 27th, an executive order is issued banning travel from seven Muslim-majority countries. Did you know anything about that until it was issued?
No, and that's the remarkable thing. I'm sitting right there in Don McGahn's office talking to him at length, and he doesn't tell me that the president at this point has already signed an executive order, as you said, banning immigration from these countries, and that the Department of Justice is going to have to be in court the very next morning defending this.
So how did you find out about the travel ban?
I was in the car. I was literally in the car on the way to the airport, and I get a call. I was able to keep one aide with me, one assistant, my principal deputy, the top deputy, the whole time. And so Matt calls me, and he says, after you left, I went online. I was reading the New York Times, and it looks like President Trump has issued some sort of travel ban. We spent the weekend trying to get our arms around and communicating with the White House of what is it that you're trying to do. And by Monday morning, I was told that we would have to take a position on the constitutionality of the travel ban the next morning in a case. So we convened everybody in my conference room and spent a very long time in there talking through what the challenges were, what the White House position was in terms of the scope of the travel ban. We talked about the different challenges, both constitutionally and statutorily and otherwise, that had been filed. And at the end of that conversation, I was not satisfied that it was lawful or constitutional. And what troubled me beyond that was that it became eminently clear that to defend the constitutionality of this, I was going to have to send Department of Justice lawyers in to take the position that this travel ban that applied just to Muslim-majority countries had absolutely nothing to do with religion. And this was in the face of all of the president's statements that he had made, both on the campaign trail and after he had been elected. And that did not seem like the truth to me.
But isn't it usually the job of the Department of Justice to defend actions of the administration, even if you personally would not have done, issued that order? Or you're the president, you're the executive branch's lawyers.
Right.
So why wasn't that good enough for you to say, I'm going to defend this?
Well, it wasn't just that I disagreed with this on a policy ground. Perhaps the appropriate thing then to do would be to resign if you can't be part of that. But not direct the department not to defend it. But here's what's different, is that I happen to believe no litigant should go into court and make an argument that's not grounded in truth. But the Department of Justice, I mean, if DOJ stands for anything, it's supposed to stand for what is true and what is just.
So what did you do?
I knew that I personally couldn't be part of defending this and arguing something that wasn't grounded in truth. But I thought about, maybe the thing to do is resign. And that would have protected my personal integrity. I wouldn't have been part of this. But I wasn't like just the head of the civil division or, you know, some other component of the department. I was the acting Attorney General of the United States, and I felt like I had a responsibility to protect not just my personal integrity, but the integrity of the Department of Justice as well. And I thought back to my confirmation hearing when there were some senators, including Senator Sessions, who they were all over me at my confirmation hearing about what I would do if the president asked me to do something that was unlawful or wrong. And I think Senator Sessions said, you know, even if it's just something that would bring disrepute to the Department of Justice, you know, you're going to be asked to do that, and will you say no? You know, none of them were asking me, will you resign? They were asking me, will you say no? And they were right about that. It wasn't my responsibility in that position, I think, to resign. I think it was my responsibility to say no.
So how did you say no? It wasn't like a public statement. It was just a communication.
No, we had both. There were communications going on at levels below me and between me and Mr. McGann, and I issued the directive to the department.
And then what happened?
I was fired.
You were fired by Donald Trump before it was fashionable to be fired by Donald Trump. Did that surprise you, or how did you think this story was going to end once you said you weren't going to allow the travel ban to be defended?
Look, I certainly recognize there was a very real possibility, I would say probability, that I would be fired in this context. But I hoped that maybe there was a chance that by doing this, that would cause them to step back and take a breath and look at what they were doing. And more, okay, I know.
Everybody's
right, so you guys
laughing.
Think I was, no.
Yeah. It's impolite to laugh at the former Attorney General of the United States.
It seems kind of silly now, doesn't it? But, you know, I did harbor this hope that maybe they would step back. They would have the kind of process. They would get the kind of input. There would be real discussion about this. I had spent 27 years at the Department of Justice. I loved that place. I did not want to have the period on my service there being fired.
What's your assessment of the whole series of events?
I suppose you could say that the president had made a campaign promise, and he was making good on that promise. But beyond the fact that I believe that particularly the first one was unlawful and unconstitutional, I think it's absolutely the antithesis of who we are as a country. And
we're listening to Sally Yates, a longtime Justice Department official who was the acting Attorney General at the start of the Trump administration. Sally Yates spoke with Jeffrey Toobin at the New Yorker Festival.
Now, as you mentioned, the travel ban was revised once. Mm-hmm. It was revised twice. The courts had struck down each of the versions, including the third and final version, until it went to the Supreme Court, which upheld it 5-4. Mm-hmm. What's your view of the travel ban in its final form and of the Supreme Court's decision about it?
You know, I haven't studied Travel Ban 3 the same way that I did the first one. You know, I still, despite the other revisions of, you know, taking out the preference for Christians and throwing in a couple of, you know, non-Muslim majority countries, despite the fact that, you know, they made some changes, you know, I am still troubled by the animus that I believe infected the first as well as the final travel ban.
And we've had this paradoxical situation since Jeff Sessions has been Attorney General, where he has been, in the policy areas you talk about, very much advancing the Trump agenda. At the same time, the president has been just beating the hell out of him in public. What do you make of that? I mean, what do you make of that?
What's up with that?
Yeah, what's up with that? Thank you.
You know, I mean, I think he clearly has been trying to humiliate him into resigning. I mean, that, you know, that's been going on for so long now, it like doesn't even make the news anymore. But when it became clear, I think, that Attorney General Sessions was not going to resign, now he seems determined to undermine the legitimacy of the department and the FBI and anybody else who is involved with the Russia probe, I believe, to delegitimize any findings from that probe. It's certainly elevating himself and being willing to tear down critical democratic institutions for self-protection.
What about the role of Rod Rosenstein? Rod Rosenstein definitely has raised the profile of deputy attorney generals. You thought you were famous. Rod Rosenstein is maybe the most famous lawyer in America. He is, because Attorney General Sessions is recused, he is the supervisor of the Mueller investigation. Yeah. How do you think Rosenstein has handled that?
I think he's done a really good job of that. I think, you know,
you've known Rosenstein?
Oh, yeah, I knew him back when we were U.S. attorneys together in the Obama administration, and so I've known Rod for a long time. And look, I know everybody for a while was so focused on making sure that we protect Robert Mueller. And goodness knows, I think we need to protect Bob Mueller. But it's equally as important to protect Rod Rosenstein right now, because he really has control over what ultimately happens in this investigation.
I mean, in fact, the report that Mueller writes doesn't go to Congress. It goes to the deputy, it goes to his supervisor, who is the deputy attorney general. So you could have a deputy attorney general who receives the report and says, thank you very much, puts it in a drawer, and that's the end of the story.
And that certainly seems to be the course that our president would think that that person should take.
Well, it does seem like, I mean, the president has all but written on a wall that he's going to fire the attorney general after the midterms. Do you think he's going to fire Rosenstein too?
You know, far be it from me to get in Donald Trump's head.
Yeah.
You know, he's walked them both up to the guillotine multiple times now, only to then pull back. So it's hard to know if it's one or the other, or he does it in a swoop, or neither, and he just continues to torture them. It's kind of hard to know. It's whatever I think he thinks will be best for him.
The president appoints the attorney general. Mm-hmm. Is he the president's lawyer? Is he the people's lawyer? What is the role and what's the relationship? What should it be? Because it's not a simple thing.
No, and I get that a lot of people might look and say, look, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch, just like the Department of Agriculture or Commerce or any of the other agencies, and you answer to the president, you're the president's lawyer. That is so not true. And I remember, actually, when I first became U.S. attorney, and we all went to the White House for what was essentially a photo op with Eric Holder, attorney general then. And, you know, we're all lined up in the bleachers in the East Room there for the president to come in. And you know, he comes in and he looked at us there and said, look, I have appointed each and every one of you, and I know you're going to do a great job, but there's only one thing you need to remember, and that is you don't represent me. You represent the people of the United States. And as long as you remember that, you're going to do your job and everything's going to be okay.
So, that's so 2009.
Yeah, yeah.
let me read you a tweet from President Trump, which relates a little to the criminal justice dimension. Very sad that the FBI missed all the many signals sent out by the Florida school shooter. This was the Parkland shooting, the high school. This is not acceptable. They are spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. There is no collusion. Get back to the basics and make us all proud. I know you're...
It's just...
You can't be at a loss for word. It's the New Yorker Festival.
Okay. Sickening. I mean, he's taking a tragedy where children were killed, and he is using that tragedy to attack an investigation of his own campaign.
What effect do you think this, the kind of criticism of DOJ, the criticism of the FBI, has day to day?
Well, let me say what effect I don't think it has first.
Okay.
I don't think it impacts the substantive decisions that are being made by the line prosecutors and the line agents there. Folks having confidence in DOJ and the FBI, that has real life consequences.
When
agents go knocking on doors to try to find witnesses or others to provide information in cases, when you are sowing that kind of distrust, that has a real impact on public safety. When juries are sitting in trials and are hearing testimony from FBI agents, and they're thinking about what their president has said about how, you know, they're liars and all, you know, part of a deep state trying to undermine this administration, that can't help but have an impact there. And I think that, you know, the public's confidence in our criminal justice system is essential for that system to be able to work. And that, to me, is one of the great tragedies of all of this, is how that's being abused. One of the things I really worry about is, where are we when this administration is over? I mean, what's the new normal at that point? What have we so debased, not just public discourse, but the dignity of the presidency and Congress and the Department of Justice and others, that we look and are entirely different than we were before? How's that for a
oh,
down?
God.
I'm sorry, God. That is, yeah. God, I depressed myself with that.
you are now a partner at King & Spalding, big firm. And a lot of people want you to run for office. Is that going to happen?
No, well, that's it.
I knew I'd get that reaction. I pander with the best of them, yes.
Now, you know, when people have mentioned that, I'm incredibly flattered. Doesn't even feel like the right word there. I mean, it means a lot to me that people have said that they would like me to do that or would trust me to do that. Public service, absolutely. I mean, that's in my heart, and I believe in that. Running for office just feels very different to me than that. I just have a hard time seeing running for office.
But if a different president wanted to call you back to Washington, wouldn't be out of the question for you to go?
I believe in public service.
There we go. All right. Please join me in thanking Grace Salier.
Sally Yates, former Deputy Attorney General, and briefly, ever so briefly, the Acting Attorney General, speaking with Jeffrey Toobin at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month. We'll hear one more conversation from the festival with a live performance when Vincent Cunningham talks with the R&B singer, Kalela.
Then I'm in my right. Anything I left behind don't mean nothing.
That's up next on the New Yorker Radio
Hour.
I'm David Remnick. The actor Daniel Radcliffe is on Broadway right now in a play that's called The Lifespan of a Fact. His character is a fact checker, and to prepare for that role, Radcliffe decided to study up with the real pros.
Is brunch served 7 days a week?
Yes.
That's great news for the accuracy of this and for me.
Daniel Radcliffe at The New Yorker. That's next week.
Thank you.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Can I get more vocal in my ears, please?
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. Earlier this month at the New Yorker Festival, I was really excited to talk to the R&B singer Kalela. Her music is this wonderful mix of sounds. Sometimes it's woozy along the lines of trip-hop or electronica. At other times, she sounds like a 90s vocalist along the lines of Janet Jackson.
You don't know.
There's a real intelligence in her music, and it points to someone who really understands and appreciates the sources of her own music, and also kind of implicates where that music might go in the future. So we talked, and then she also gave an incredible live performance along with one of her producers and DJs, Lorik C. Thank you so much for being here with us for the 19th New Yorker Festival and for this talk with Coletta. First of all, I have immense respect for any singer or performer or anybody who goes with just the first name. That's a power move as far as I'm concerned. Can you tell, how did you decide, you know, how you wanted to present yourself in that way?
Well, I was really committed to the full name, Coletta Mizan-Christos. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be known first and last. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, Coletta's distinct enough.
Right.
And you're gonna run into issues when people try to search your name, basically.
Yeah, very strong from this angle, I just gotta say.
Thank you.
I know you grew up in the DC area and there was a sort of thriving culture of music. What were the things you were listening to as you were starting to perform and to start writing songs? How did that all those influences come together?
You know, it's really weird because, you know, I feel like I've grown up in a really, it's an intersectional experience. You know, there's a lot of things going on at the same time. You know, I'm a daughter of immigrants, of African immigrants, East African immigrants, particularly Ethiopians. And then there's the layer of growing up in a suburb of DC, being bused from a, you know, ghetto suburb to a whiter suburb and what that means. You know, there's a particular way that you're processing the world when your school is extremely segregated. I would say that's the case for everybody, but
yeah,
there's a way it was happening in my school. So I was listening to a lot of different things. You know, I was obsessed with R&B. Any R&B vocal was just, that was like zero. That was home base. And I would say before that, I was listening to jazz and world music and just, you know, a lot of traditional music. And then I remember my ex-boyfriend, my first boyfriend had a Napster membership, one of the first.
Oh, wow. We were all in
and
on
I
that
got
scam,
Napster in the divorce, you know? So I kept that membership for a few years to survey every female vocal, period. I was just on a mission to just scan the world for every single type of singing.
Yeah.
And so I just would learn music in other languages, but mainly jazz. You know, that was the thing that I was sort of serving the most. And so, you know, I've had different periods where I was just immersed in one sound. And then after that, it was sort of a really experimental music, you know?
Yeah.
So electronic and experimental music. When I think about my experimental electronic music side, a lot of those references are still black because I'm thinking about Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, or I'm thinking about Bootsy Collins, or, you know, just even Miles Davis or Herbie's.
Yeah. What was it about R&B that made it sort of that, you said you were kind of more into jazz first, and it sounds like R&B had some pull on you.
I guess it was just pop music. That was, you know, like there's a way that, you know, you can't, there's no camaraderie around jazz when you get to your elementary school.
The jazz club's not where you want to be, right?
You feel me?
There's no,
you know, get to kindergarten and people being like, you know,
blue and green,
the evening breeze, you know, it's not, it's not that. So
Yeah,
I think that is just the pull. It's the thing that happens to every human, small human being when they see Michael Jackson for the first time, or when they see, you know, when they hear Mariah, or just any of those sort of big, huge artists will have that pull, you know? But, you know, my love for jazz never died.
I'm looking, I can't keep my head up. Cause we're talking late at night. I started a song, then I gave up. So I hope this comes out right. Don't say you're in love. Don't say you're in love until you learn to take me apart. Wait it up all night. Take me apart. I wait up all night.
In jazz, it's part of what you're supposed to do is right. Reinterpret the standard, you know? That's how you get good. So for me, I've always just been interested in how those things could be flipped and represented to you so that you like it in a different way.
Speaking of reinterpretation, is there like a song you haven't sung that you want to sing? Any song, it might not
any
be a standard,
song.
Any song that you like, it needs that Kalela sauce on it, and you are...
that Kalela sauce. There are some songs. There's a song called 30 Years by Betty Carter. It's one of my favorite songs in the world. There's a few jazz songs that I'm just like waiting for the prompt, you know, waiting for the... for the appropriate context for. There's a whole, I think, organic instruments side to what I do.
How do you sort of manage the business of Kalela? There's the sort of art that you engage in, but then there's also just like the entity that is you. How do you toggle between those two?
It has taken a lot of intention to rally people around who I actually am and not a projection of what they would like me to be.
Yeah.
That is, I think, a struggle for any artist out there. But there's a particular way that, as a Black woman, I'm being asked to present myself while also being undervalued in the grand scheme. There are certain things that just feel very much off limits and just sort of out of reach. Not because I think I'm not excellent, but just because I'm a brown-skinned Black woman.
When you say things, ways that people will perceive you, or what are those things that
beyond
you that feel?
Beyond perceive me, so like those perceptions really turn into opportunities being available to you or not, just like a very bottom line.
Yeah.
My process through being a businesswoman and an artist has been to get really good at saying no while also, I guess, not killing the vibe. You know? Sometimes you have to kill the vibe, you know? Sometimes the vibe just needs to be killed dead, you know? But other times, there's a way that you want to navigate. You want to shut it down. You want to shut it down, but you don't want to shut them down, you know? So you're trying to express a problem with a dynamic. My business sort of plan is one that's meant to challenge the status quo. It's meant to challenge establishment such that people on the outside will have to deal with, you know, me saying, no, I'm going to bring my own glam. I can't rely on you.
Yeah.
I can't rely on you because you just have never shown up in that way, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many ways I have to do that. I have to assert myself. You can't do this because that's just not how it's done. But how come that white girl did it? I saw her do it. Why can't I do that too? So yeah, there's just a zillion ways that it's come up, and everybody's had to go through some sort of like training, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Informal.
So what you just described sounds like a whole lot of work, right? Do you think that that work has made it easier for you to do the fundamental thing of like getting yourself across?
Yes, because I was under so much stress before, trying to navigate, you know, trying to be an artist and like protect myself.
Yeah.
Now I have people who are on the outside who are like, sorry, you can't go in there. You know, figuratively speaking, and that makes a huge, that makes me a great deal less stressed out. You know, it's brought me so much solace to know that the people that I'm working with closely are really for me in that way. And not just for my art, and I think that's actually the issue. That's actually part of a Black woman's experience, is feeling like your output is so valued, you know? People love the runs, but they can't love the experience that it comes from. And that's the end of our talk.
Yeah. I was going to ask something else, but that's exactly somebody. Where to go. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Let's have some more music.
So let me know. I'm not gonna wait if you hesitate, so let me know.
That's Kalela performing at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month, and she spoke with staff writer Vincent Cunningham. I'm David Remnick, and next week, we're going to follow a gas pipeline that's redrawing the political map in parts of the state of Pennsylvania. And we'll peek over Daniel Radcliffe's shoulder as he gets a lesson in fact-checking to prepare for his new role on Broadway. That's next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. I hope you'll join us.
You gotta do is let me know.
Thank you.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Bradley G., Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Land Rover. Invest in Rocky Mountain Passes. Trade in hedge funds for tropical rainforest funds. Put your money into wondrous real estate you won't find on any broker's website. Adventure, it's yours for the taking. With a new Land Rover as your companion, you'll see adventure wherever you go. Visit your local Land Rover retailer for special offers on the 2019 Range Rover. Adventure, it's yours for the taking. Land Rover, above and beyond.